All right. Hi, everybody. It's RCFB Talk 191. It's Tuesday night. This is when we like to talk to you about whatever you'd like to discuss in college football. My name is Bob Ekhayeri. I'm your regular co-host for this show. Lots of things going on. We can talk about certainly news in college football, the portal, the draft just happened. There's apparently a settlement talk happening on two of the most important NCAA cases. Spring games have been going on. Lots of things to talk about and some of the more odds and ends that are out there. Looks like John wants to join the conversation. By the way, I do promise you we'll try not to be mid, as Shador Sanders described one of his teammates who was quoted on departing on the experience of departing Colorado last season. The Athletic had done an article tracking where some of the folks who left the program have ended up. And Shador Sanders apparently responded to former teammate Xavier Smith's claim that the school doesn't show compassion by saying, in a quote, teat, I don't remember him, to be honest. Bro had to be very mid at best. Anyway, John, you've been patient. It's good to hear from you. What's going on?
Hey, man. How you been?
Good. You know, it's so funny. I teach a class at the University of Minnesota. It's already wrapped up, so it's always on Tuesdays. So I nearly forgot about the show. I got to put an alarm because I'm so used to like, all right, I'm driving home at night. I got my like ready to go jump into this. And I was like, somebody like texted me, hey, good luck tonight. I'm like, why? What's? I'm like, oh, it's Tuesday. So I got to set an alarm. I have to do that for the whole summer. But yeah, no. So anyway, I'm here. And it's so funny too, because there's so much to talk about. And I'm planning a trip, and I know I've mentioned it before. This weekend, I'm going out to Southern Oregon to actually cover a football game because they're hosting Japan's college football champion is going to play in Southern Oregon against a team from the NAIA, the Southern Oregon Raiders. So I figured, you know, why not? I'll go out there. It'll be something different. I haven't been out there flying into Medford. It's going to be raining apparently the entire game, which is very much about what the weather is like in that part of the Pacific Northwest. So it'll be interesting, but yeah, how are you?
Not too bad. I mean, that sounds pretty cool. I'm not gonna lie. I think I've been craving some college football again because I watched a little bit of that Japan game at like 1 a.m. in the morning, realizing I need to go outside maybe a little bit more. But yeah, you know, just the draft was interesting. As a Taylor Heineke and a Falcons fan, it was a really rough Thursday. knowing that your favorite quarterback. Well, you grew up watching college, and your team made a very interesting decision with the first round of the draft this year. But the main thing I want to talk about is the fact that so many quarterbacks were picked with the first, 12 to 15 picks this year, six of them. Is the belief that next year's quarterback group do we think they're not pro ready, or is this maybe there's not a lot of it's a weak class. I'm very curious of how the professional and how scouts look at next year's quarterbacks. I think there's some good quarterbacks in college football next year. It seemed very confusing that it seemed there's a lot of panic buying by teams this year.
Yeah, you know, one of the better pieces of analysis I read was that the current – and it's so funny because the draft has evolved. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when running backs went high. And then I think as a collective group, the NFL realized, you know what? These guys don't last that long, and guaranteeing, $10 million. Yeah, I'm looking at I was actually looking back to the 97 draft because I was having a conversation about big draft bust. Ryan Leaf is obviously a classic, and I'm old enough to, again, remember that season. And I was looking at the other guys drafted because there were in the top five, there were two busts and one of them was running back. Yeah, they gave him $14 million guaranteed. And no fault of his own. He started one game, blew out his knee on the second game and was out of the league in 2 years. So that's why they kind of fell out of fashion. Now, at this stage in the draft, the history of the draft, it seems like they don't quite know how to value quarterbacks. So they're either being valued way too high or just completely they're a work in progress. We'll get to them because there was that chasm that opened up between Bo Nix as number 12 and, Spencer Rattler all the way back on, I forgot what pick he was. But again, there was that big chasm that opened up. So it was definitely interesting to see so many quarterbacks go. I think it's the most quarterbacks in the top 12 that have ever been picked. So it certainly kind of speaks to the evolution of the draft right now. Now, as for next season, that may be playing a bit into it. I mean, Carson Beck is absolutely going to be of interest. Shador Sanders, you know, all the stuff we just I just mentioned aside, you know, he's got talent that's got the draft interested. I think Quinn Ewers, if he can be more consistent, is also going to be up there because again, Texas looks strong enough to be competitive. But then beyond that, I mean, there's Jalen Milroe certainly could, and then the guy who I think is the most interesting, and I think part of the reason why he stayed is he realized he was going to be on the other end of the chasm, and that was Cam Ward. Now they thought he might be a top 100 pick. I'm not sure. Maybe he would have only jumped up, but again, I think the play at Wazoo had some concern, and I think perhaps, and that's kind of a fascinating thing. Like somebody pointed this out, the guaranteed money in like the 17th. Pardon me, 17th. We're not in the olden days draft where they went like a billion rounds. In the 7th round, a draftee is supposed to get like, I think approximately they estimate guaranteed like $90,000, which is a good amount of money, but not like, you know, what obviously Caleb Williams is going to be getting in guaranteed money. So for a lot of guys, they're staying in and taking NIL money because, you know, it's a tight fit to get into the NFL. I mean, you're fighting for only so many spots and they're taking so many people that just simply can't all be like, we did the math on this show I do for Advanced Media with Sean Jayaraja, but I did the math and there were it's 200, however many picks. Then they take all the undrafted free agents. So when you conservatively, there's like 600 people vying to be on NFL, pardon me, 600 undrafted free agents. So there's actually more like 900 total people every year trying to get as a rookie contract in a league that's got less than 1,700 people on rosters because that's a very fixed number. So it's like 1,600 and like change. So, you know, all these guys trying, I don't blame them when they want to go back and get a little bit more money. And so that may have influenced Cam Ward as well. I mean, the guaranteed money to probably go play for Miami for a season would have probably been more. But he also be a guy I'd be curious if he can kind of step it up with a more talented team overall. I think he would also. But again, it isn't quite as deep as this season. And part of it could also be the holdover of the COVID years. We had a lot of guys that were super experienced. I mean, heck, if we're talking about the Falcons, they picked, yeah, you know, he's just a shy of 24 years old, Michael Penix Jr. So that veteran kind of nature of it is interesting, too. I mean, I love it. Miami, we've talked about it a couple weeks ago, maybe a couple months ago at this point, but Miami's got a guy who somehow is going into his 9th season. I think he started at Oregon. I think we did the math when he started as a freshman. The freshmen now were 10. So you can make a lifelong career apparently out of being a college football player these days. It's fascinating. You know, I wanna also allow, we've got a couple other people who want to join in the conversation. Nathan, you've been super patient, and I'll try and get Alex up here as well. John, can you hear him, or is it my side?
Yeah, I think it's your side. I hear Nathan.
Okay, sorry about that, Nathan. I'm gonna reset my side. I'll be right back. This is just a classic problem we sometimes have with Twitter Spaces. I'll be back in 1 second.
Hey, no worries. I was going to say, speaking to the quarterbacks, I think if I was a betting man right now, after watching Nebraska's spring game, I would put some decent money on Dylan Raiola going number one in the 2027 draft. As a Nebraska fan, you know, it's pretty refreshing, guys.
And I'm back. Sorry about that, Nathan. I really apologize. It's an annoying hiccup that sometimes happens.
Well, I just started. You missed out, but I was started out on my celebratory rant about Dylan Raiola being a competent quarterback.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. I mean, Nebraska fans have to be celebrating about that. I mean, everyone has, you know, they wanted to believe, but they didn't, you know, who wanted to overcommit to it? But then the spring game looked great. I mean, you know, let's set aside all the, it's a spring game and set up for potential success and all of that stuff. I mean, it's like the ceiling was pretty low already. So he burst through already a low ceiling. And I think if Nebraska can just get even a modest offense going, they're going to be so much better this season. I mean, bowl, I think, is on the table. I don't want to go beyond that because that would be a little bit crazy. But, you know, I think I was actually looking at how some of the reactions were on RCFB when it came up with the spring game numbers. And it's so funny because some teams don't even keep up spring game numbers. They're just, that's all right. It is, you know. But I love it. The top comment from Littner Williams, who's a Nebraska fan, is, "We may never lose again."
Yeah,
so it's gonna be 19. It's gonna be the 1990s all over again, ain't it?
Right. I mean, just on campus, walking around, the air smells a little fresher. The trees are a little greener. You know, there's hope in the air, and that's all you can ask for as a Husker fan.
Were you at the spring game?
Unfortunately, I was not. I was out of town. I was in D.C. But I watched, you know, the highlights about 17,000 times. So,
yeah, I'm excited. I think Nebraska is going to be fun to watch this season. I mean, because it's going to be fun. I've always have a soft spot for Nebraska, you know, football. I mean, I've been to the game in Lincoln. I know how friendly the fans are, as long as you're not from Colorado. yeah. I know, like, the whole vibe there. And I mean, you know, UTEP will be a tune-up game. I'm not expecting much from there, but man, oh man, week two, Colorado coming back, the revenge game. Oh goodness. And the fact that it's the prime Colorado, I mean, like him or hate him, that's going to set up just, I cannot wait to see how this goes down. Because I'm here in Minnesota, and you know, I covered the game. I was in the press box for last season's opener, and that was a classic game. I remember I told people, I'm like, I can't tell if these teams have great defense or if these quarterbacks just stink. Turns out it was the latter. Well, the defenses were good, but you know, boy, were the offenses terrible, as it turned out.
Yeah, Jeff Sims was not the man that a lot of people bought in him being, but you know, he gave it his best shot. So but you know what? I'm so excited for that Colorado game for a couple of reasons. One, because I hate Colorado and every Nebraskan does. And two, it's really interesting watching how two coaches have decided to build their programs coming in the same year. You got Colorado, who basically flipped their roster in one season, which is pretty unheard of in college football. And you have Nebraska, who, you know, kept most of the same guys, you know, wanting to establish themselves as a developmental program. And as much as we hate Wisconsin and Iowa and those other Big Ten West teams, we're looking at teams that have had success with similar recruiting bases like we do in our 500-mile radius. And they've had success being developmental programs, and I think Matt Rhule is trying to mirror that. So it's kind of interesting watching those two different roster-building styles clash in year two.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's going to be interesting, too. We're going to hear – I mean, it's already been almost overplayed, but I don't – I hesitate to say overplayed only because it worked twice. The classic Matt Rhule year two, year three, we're going to continually hear it. You know, this is the, you know, the first year always kind of goes not great. Of course, you know, if you stack up the year one at Nebraska with year one at Temple and Baylor, much better in comparison. How will year two go? And then everyone's still going to be looking forward to seeing how year three, and if it kind of follows a pattern that we see with Matt Rhule. I mean, that was when I admit, like, even more Scott Frost, I thought was neat and everything, but like when the hiring process, I remember the excitement. But Matt Rhule was, I was like, okay, wow, that would actually be a tremendous hire for Nebraska, especially a team that has talent, has that ability, has the support, but you know, you can build something there. You know, it isn't quite as I mean, I don't want to say frivolous, but it isn't also the instantaneous, like, you can't do the Matt Rhule process at, like, if suddenly they needed him at Ohio State. Like, they would not have patience for the first 2 years.
No, and I, you know, I think that the thing that's understated about Matt Rhule is he wants to play Nebraska football. Scott Frost really didn't. Scott Frost wanted to run the Oregon offense in Nebraska, and that just realistically was never going to happen with Nebraska's recruiting base. You know, they're not going to... Sorry if you hear that alarm.
I was about to say.
But I was going to say, oh, yeah. With Nebraska's recruiting base, your best recruits in-state, more often than not, I mean, you do have guys like Malachi Coleman every now and then, but they're going to be linemen. They're going to be tight ends. They're going to be running backs and linebackers. And realistically, that's why Nebraska football was the way it was for so long. Went in the trenches, went on the ground. And that's what Matt Rhule wants to do. You know, you have a guy like Dylan Raiola who can take the top off and, you know, complete passes and not throw interceptions and not fumble the ball. But this is still a team that wants to establish its identity on the ground, and I praise Matt Rhule for keeping that. Because Scott Frost didn't work for a myriad of reasons, but one of them was he abandoned the identity of Nebraska football.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, one of the reasons I also had a good time in Nebraska is it was a Bill Callahan coach team. So that was the what, you know, the record skip, you know, wow, they really went in a different direction there.
Speaking of the identity of Nebraska football.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us today. Feel free to stay up here. I'm going to let in Alex too, because you've been super patient. And again, sorry about the hiccup with the sound. It's a known problem. It's been for like 2 years. So I'm not going to say it was like when it became X. It predates it. It was just this weird hiccup where sometimes the host can't hear guests and everyone else can. And it's really awkward because then I just talk over people.
I got you. No worries at all. You know, we're really appreciative of stuff like this. We're starting to hit the lull now. Spring games
exactly.
Over with. NFL drafts over with. Portal windows coming to a close. And as we're hitting the dog days here. I just want to draw attention to something that just took place for me personally in my life with college football that is going to affect me negatively. And that is the NCAA 14 servers seem to have gone down for online competition. Yes, this is... We've had a ongoing online dynasty since COVID locked in and, you know, kind of ruined everything, but also most importantly, all of our what's near and dear to our hearts, college football. So we all got together and have kept it running. And boy, this has happened a couple of times, but it's starting to feel pretty real right now that dream might be over with until the newest game comes out.
Boy, that would be a crisis. It truly would be. I hope it comes back on. Apparently, some of them have. I was trying to look up if there was any recent comment on that. Apparently, it occasionally has gone down in the past. So hopefully, this.
Oh yeah, there's dozens of us. There's dozens of us that are freaking out about this.
Oh man, but I mean, yeah, no. I hope they keep that. Would suck because I mean, everyone's looking forward to this new game. I mean, I hope it's good. I hope it's good. That's what I say about it. I'm not quite. I think maybe I'm jaded at this point with you know, my video game days go all the way back to before the original Nintendo. So I've had games, especially as a kid, where you're just hyped up and you're just like, oh, this is it. Actually, I'm from the era where the game, you know, the best games were in the arcade, and then you'd get the home version, and then it would always be nerfed in some way because there was no way a Nintendo Entertainment System could mimic an arcade machine. Or if you're as old as I was, a Commodore 64, I still. Sorry, I'm going to rant about this, but Akari Warriors, classic arcade game, rotary joystick, you know, two Rambo-like guys running around shooting stuff, was like a great arcade game. And I got my Commodore 64 version. I wasted a birthday present on it from my parents. Because you know what that's like? That's like the big present. You're like, all right, I'm going to get Akari Warriors. I load that floppy disk up, and it is just I felt dead inside when I saw how this game played.
That's brutal.
And then years later, I read a review and everyone's like, yeah, that was one of the worst ports of any game ever made. And I'm like, all right, I feel vindicated 20 years later. But but NCAA football, I'm hoping it's going to be great. I'm hoping, I mean, now, you know, they're doing a great job of milking the news on it because on RCFB, we'll see like posts like, hey, they just said that it's going to have a current player on the cover. And I'm like, well, this is news? This is like, what did y'all expect after NIL?
Well, let's take to the streets. We got to get the picket fences going, and we got to get this game back online for two
Absolutely.
More months.
But Absolutely.
Appreciate the time.
Thanks, Alex. I really appreciate it, man. Hey, John, your hand's been up. You've been patient. What's on your mind?
Well, first of all, Nathan. I think Nathan said too many positive things about Nebraska.
Well, now I can't hear John. I know, John, you're talking. I'm going to reset you right back.
Can Nathan or Alex, can you at least hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
You said too many positive things, man. I think that's why the sirens are on. I think the cops might be coming after you. I don't think I've ever heard a Nebraska fan say that many positive things in decades. So,
no, I haven't said that many positive things in probably five, six. Well, when Scott Frost got hired, you know, everybody.
Oh my goodness, what a fun evening of technical difficulties. Sorry about that, John.
No, you're good. I was just talking about how I don't think I've ever heard that many positive things about Nebraska before. That's the first.
Wow.
That's why.
Well, from a Nebraska fan?
From a Nebraska fan. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I was telling Nathan. I think that's what the sirens are on. I think that's
yeah, don't worry.
After them.
After the first incompletion, we'll all be at everybody's sorts again, so we'll be good.
But
go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to talk about quarterbacks for next year. What's your feeling about drones? I know that's a very biased thing as a Virginian, but what do you think about drones for Virginia Tech as possibly a quarterback for next season? He looked really good at the end of last year and looked like he was really hitting a groove with a team that's going to return a lot of starters for next for this fall.
Yeah, I think definitely all the analysis I've heard all, you know, in the offseason, including after the spring game, was there. It almost feels like the team's, you know, you don't want to say, because that's a stereotype, like it's all about the quarterback, but drones really is Virginia Tech football success. The perception, at least, of the fans of how they're going to do is how drones performs when they go out there. So, I mean, I don't know. Obviously, NFL prospects, I have no idea, but I mean, I think there's a lot of positivity around it, and, you know, again, when he kind of appeared, when they put him on the stage last season, he stepped up and the team looked a lot different. So I think there's a lot of positivity around that. So I think he could be great. And the ACC right now, I mean, you know, Drake May's no longer there. There's going to be some good quarterbacks there. Obviously, Cam Ward is down at Miami. But I think he could potentially emerge in a conference that has a history of putting out some major quarterbacks. I mean, especially now that the Pac-12 is gone. You know, obviously we'll have the SEC and Big Ten quarterbacks, but the ACC has a real opportunity to step up as, you know, kind of the exciting conference with exciting football. And I mean, I'm sure we're going to see the same thing. I mean, SMU's got some good quarterback play, as well as the traditional ACC members. And we'll see who Cal and Stanford throw out there. Again, because we're talking about the ACC, and this is the ACC of the future. Oh, my goodness. You know, just also wanted to mention, because I would be, as a USC fan, it's been a week. It happened like right after we did last week's show. I'm going to just say, all of us are thrilled to see Reggie Bush got the Heisman Trophy back. It was kind of a nonsense thing that was not, they were not required to take it away. It's totally unrelated to the NCAA. So it's funny because he has an ongoing lawsuit, defamation lawsuit against the NCAA that is not affected by getting a Heisman back because they were not related. They were related decisions, but they were not like directly tied decisions. Like one did not create the other. Of course, we know part of the PR there was the Heisman Trophy Trust releasing that tweet after OJ died. So, boy, that was the juice really, you know, hey, you know, say what you will. But, you know, even in death, he apparently helped the USC by getting Reggie's Heisman back. So there you go. That was kind of one of those interesting.
I don't want to interrupt, but would it have been better for them not to tweet anything in that situation? I feel like just tweeting nothing would have been a much better.
Yeah, option. That's where I was surprised. Like, if you were in that pinch, just like put a post on your website, but don't like tweet it out. Yeah, you know, I mean, because then. But I could also see, like, look, we're going to say we're going to do this. This is our policy. I wonder how much of an internal discussion there was. But I get all the reasons why they would have done it. But unfortunately, people noticed. Maybe they were just hoping, I'll just slip this one through. No one will really notice. No one will really care. But yeah, no, that definitely got that piqued attention when it occurred for sure. But yeah, you know, good for them. A lot of fun theories on how they're going to maybe work him into the Heisman House commercials if they do. That could be really funny. And again, the people are like, one of my favorite jokes was like, again, Salty Longhorn, I'll credit him. It's like, if he appears in the house, Johnny Manziel should be in the background flashing cash and like the things of the players that may have also been on board, but just were not caught. You know, one thing, again, I want to mention, just going back to the draft, that was an insane crowd. That was what, like 275,000 on that first day. We had a reporter in Detroit in the media room for the draft this season. We had one last season too in Kansas City. And again, he's a guy who's been around. Like, he has been to places, he has been to conferences, but he's like, I've never seen this many drunk people in one place. Just not 275,000 at once. And it sounded like a party. They reached capacity for an open plaza, which is just an incredible statement. I think the overall attendance was 775,000. I'm sure that included some repeat attendees, but you know, the ticketed through the door kind of, you know, that's incredible. I mean, covering it as press is actually not the greatest. Most people don't realize that. They kind of stick you in a side room, but the security there was so overwhelmed that our guy was able to kind of make it around some places. You know, because if you see on TV, they've got those hardcore fans that believe each NFL team gets allotted like 15 tickets and they give it to their true super fans. And the commitment is, though, you have to stay for all like seven rounds. So you have to be in that room and look bonkers when your team's seventh round pick gets announced. But, you know, it's an interesting event. But all I have to say is next season's going to. It can't match it. I just don't think it can. It's going to be in Green Bay. And as my favorite tweet I read, as soon as they announced it was going to be reminded it was going to be in Green Bay, is that the two hotels in Green Bay are already booked solid. So I'm not sure where people are going to go. It'll be maybe a lot of people driving up from Milwaukee. It'll be interesting to see. All I have to say is, when is it going to be? I've looked, they haven't scheduled it yet. It has to be in the French Quarter at one point. I mean, come on. They got an NFL team. I know the parking lot I would choose. It's like where they always have event, like when they had the national championship in 2020, technically it was January 2020. They used this parking lot for the Fan Fest. I mean, have the NFL draft in the French Quarter. I mean, if you really want to go crazy, try to cram it onto Bourbon Street. But, you know, that will be a phenomenon. And I'm pretty sure, because I was having a conversation with somebody about, like, why is this such a big phenomenon? I mean, you know, because the Super Bowl's big. A lot of people show up for the Super Bowl, but it's expensive. I think the fact that this is like a free event, more or less, this is like the people's NFL event. This is like, you can just show up, be yourself, who cares? I mean, Philly led the way. They're the whole reason we did it. Because they used to have it for years in New York and Radio City Music Hall. They had it for a couple years in the theater in Chicago. Then Philadelphia's where they decided to have it outdoors. And that's when they realized, we have something here. We have something exciting. And who knew? The Philly fans are the ones that led us through this. So, I mean, can't wait to see how this keeps going. This is awesome. John, what's on your mind on this?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not sure anyone's ready for the draft at the French Quarter. I've been to the French Quarter many of times for just minor holidays, and that place almost looks like it's about to break. I don't know if they can survive a draft, but I think DC, if they put it in the National Mall, the NFL draft there 1 year, I think that would be crazy. Because you get fans from all the localities. You have Philly fans, Baltimore fans, DC fans. Like, that would be such a crazy collision of worlds.
Where would you put it? Like, in front of the Lincoln Memorial? Like,
oh, yeah, 100%. Like, that's the most American thing you could ever do.
Put it in front of the Capitol, or put it in front of, like, the White House. There's so many things. Like, I can't even imagine. Like,
can you imagine? Like, yeah. It's like, that is pure Americana right there. Having a guy getting drafted first overall, Lincoln looking proudly in the background. I mean, that's American as you can get.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. Yeah, let's do that. We got to get the Commanders in on this. Oh my goodness. You know, just kind of going over the numbers, you know, some of you may remember Jim Harbaugh claimed, because he had an incredible number of people invited to the combine. He thought they might break the record of total number of draft picks from a team. They came close. The number was 15. The Wolverines had 13. And that's, you know, it's one of those numbers where it's like, I'm not going to like, you didn't make it. I mean, but they still had the most drafted, which I thought was fascinating. And Longhorns came in second at 11, Crimson Tide at 10, Florida State at 10, and Washington at 10. Georgia had 8 and Oregon had 8. And it's funny when you get to lower numbers, like, for example, one of the Ohio State only had 4 players drafted. But that's actually ominous, because some of you who may remember, Ohio State retained a lot of guys that people thought were going to go in the draft. So for some of these teams, it means they're loading up again. Nebraska, actually, so we were just talking about them. They had nobody selected in the draft. I don't think it's quite as doom and gloom or as sad as, like, Florida fans are kind of like, they also fell into this. They had a single draftee. Texas A&M, after the Jimbo era, had one lone first rounder in all of his era there. Those are signs of, you know, problems. But with Nebraska, I think it's a little more optimistic, because it's like, okay, you've saved some of your good guys for next season. You need those veteran guys. So it's kind of funny, because I was looking at these teams, who got drafted, who didn't, teams that were kind of concerned about who didn't. But I put Nebraska closer to, and I'm not saying on the talent level, but closer to what Ohio State's looking at right now, where they retained a lot of experienced guys who might have gone in the draft, who are only going to potentially make the Matt Rule year two stronger. So we'll see how that goes as that plays out. You know, one other topic I also wanted to really quickly touch on, only because it started to erupt last night, and more reporting was on it today. And that's a potential settlement in the House versus NCAA case. There's also a parallel case that is a little younger called Carter versus NCAA. So why are these cases important? House versus NCAA is the case that is the closest to going to trial, that if it went to trial has the risk of completely bringing down the current system that we have. I mean, I'm not even underselling it. Why? How could it do that? This is basically a lawsuit over back pay. Basically, players who played before NIL became the law of the land are suing to get money that they believe that they are owed. And it is a case that after what happened in Alford, where the Supreme Court ruled unanimously against the NCAA and some of these other cases that are going on right now, there is the potential, if they lose the House case, that they would be ordered to pay damages that are over $4 billion. So how would that money be distributed? It seems like it would completely wreck the NCAA. And I've mentioned it in previous shows only because while I don't think that Super League that got proposed a few months ago is going to go anywhere, that was an interesting kind of blueprint for, well, if the NCAA does get blown up, what would we replace it with? Would we kind of come up with this scenario, or would it end up just being kind of the Big Ten and SEC sort of, you know, coming up with their own kind of creation? But this case, it's still early. And I mean, there's a lot of ways settlement talks can collapse, but it did come up. They're looking at potentially figuring out the compensation owed to college athletes for universities using their NIL in broadcasts, future compensation. So they'd be looking at basically paying out to past players and figuring out how the universities might divide up that pool, and then coming up with a way of moving forward, how revenue sharing might work. And the numbers apparently being bandied about is that, and this might only apply to major schools, quite frankly, because, for example, Akron ain't pulling in this kind of money, but it might be like a major university would be sharing $15 to $20 million of their broadcast revenue in a way that's divided up among the team. There's reasons to settle. I have to say, I mean, my background is, you know, I teach law. I'm a lawyer by training, and you know, you settle when you don't want to. It's settlement is one thing. It's certainty. You know exactly what's going to happen. You can control the loss. You know you might lose. So let's say you get into a car accident, and the company that you're suing, let's say a Walmart truck runs red light and hits you. Walmart knows, like, if this goes to trial, first of all, we're going to lose. First of all, everyone's going to be like, oh, it was Walmart. Let's throw the book at them. So you just want to, like, all right, here, what are your medical bills? You know, they have actuaries, you know, the magical magicians who know roughly how much it's going to cost to take care of you for the rest of your life. All right, here's the cat check. Take it. You know, that's a settlement. So in this case, NCAA has now seen what happened in the Supreme Court, has been losing case after case, knows that the risk of this going to a jury or wherever it ends up could cost them, you know, $4 billion or more. You try to come up with a number that's less than that and something that you can control, you're hemorrhaging, and there's a level of certainty there. So that means that, you know, you sell for maybe $1 to $2 billion versus like $4 to $6 billion. So that might be one major reason to do that. It could also basically end the possibility of some lawsuits. However, some of the criticism, I always recommend Michael McCann, Professor Michael McCann at the University of New Hampshire, who is a very accessible writer when he writes about legal issues. He's pointed out, again, this may not preclude other potential lawsuits. There may be more lawsuits in the future. Certainly won't address NIL if there's battles over NIL in terms of however it's being run. And there are some other parallel court cases out there. This thing, this whole House case, and to a lesser extent, Carter case, has been floating around in the background as one of the major factors in why we're going to eventually probably see a move to paying the players. But the other major factor is just the fact that the way NIL has run right now is, unless Congress passes a law, which it, at this point almost certainly will not do, especially not in election year, there's going to be a judge that's going to eventually say, these guys are operating as employees, just not in that formal title. So one way or the other, the players are going to get more money. But it seems to be interesting to see how this gets settled. So I just wanted to bring that up because it's a hot topic to administrators, but it is one of those topics where for a college football fan, college sports fan, House versus the NCAA, one day, like if it settles, it'll be a great day. But if it doesn't, it goes to trial, there's going to be a random day out there where people who aren't like more casual fans are going to hear like, wait, the NCAA is gone? How did that happen? And it's going to be because of this lawsuit, because it truly, truly is that big of a deal. But I've been blathering on about that quite a bit. Elizabeth, you've been super patient. What's on your mind? And I'll let up Mark as well.
Hey, Bobak. No, great stuff. First, I want to say that I love Nebraska football. So Nathan, I love your enthusiasm. That's fantastic to hear. I was really so hopeful when Scott Frost was named the coach. I mean, he was born in Lincoln, played at Nebraska, and then it just, like you said, it just, his coaching style didn't work out. And then I did see something, and Bobak, correct me if I'm wrong. I saw a post that in the last 5 years that Nebraska has not put any players in the NFL. Could that be correct?
No, that's not true.
That can't be correct, right?
Yeah, no. I think the post was that it was just no one was drafted in the for the second time in 5 years. So people have been drafted. I'm sure people have been undrafted free agents. I mean, every year you're going to get
right. But because that seemed extreme and incorrect. Because I'm like, wait a minute, that can't be possible. And then secondly, I'm so happy for Reggie Bush. The NCAA. I mean, my gosh, they charged Arkansas players for, I think it was a few years back. Do you remember when they were so particular about like foods, like on Sunday they had a bagel, but they could have jelly, but not cream cheese. If they have cream cheese, they get a fine. I'm like, are you kidding? Really? That can't be true. And I looked it up and it was true. There were limitations on what you could put on a bagel.
I remember those days. That was the hot controversy in those days. It just seems so quaint now.
I know. I just reflecting back, I thought it was just really interesting going now that there's so much many bigger picture topics with the NIL and everything to be reflecting on jelly or cream cheese and being fined by that. So
yeah, now we're talking about, well, which option package are you getting on the Lamborghini?
Rick Majerus got in trouble for buying a kid a hamburger whose father died as well.
Remember that?
I mean, it's wild how things have changed.
Oh, Rick Majerus. I love the guy, but he kind of burned my alma mater. Some people may not remember this, but because obviously Rick was the head, for those who don't remember, great basketball coach, late basketball coach. He passed over 12 years now, but he was Utah. He took Utah, I believe it was to the Final Four. I remember that season.
Championship, actually. It was number two.
Oh, yes. Yes, it was a championship. So he takes
the Fat Man, took him to number two.
And then he took a break for a couple of years. And then he said, like, I'm going to go join the USC Trojans. This is like when USC was in the height of the Pete Carroll years. He's like, I'll go. You know, he goes to the press conference. He was like complete, you know, easygoing. Because the thing was, at Utah, he famously lived out of a hotel room his whole time there. He just said, I like it. I don't have to worry about things. They take care of me. And USC is like, oh, I'm going to settle in LA. This is it. I want to buy a house. You know, and then he even, like, in his quaint way, he made mistakes, but people liked him for. He mistook USC for Florida State. He's like, I'll get on the horse if they want me to. Both schools have a horse. I'll throw the spear if they want me to. I'm like, oh, that's actually the other. That's actually Florida State. We have a Trojan. We don't have a guy with a flaming spear. And then, like, 4 days later, he's like, you know what? I actually don't want to coach anymore. So then he went back into broadcasting and then came back a few years later to do to coach St. Louis until he passed, unfortunately. I mean, again, it was a tragic thing to see him die, but he died of heart failure. But man, he was a character, though. He was an absolute character, and I do remember the hamburger incident. He is just a nice guy. Like, that's the thing. You knew the guy wasn't trying to be, you know, the guy liked brats. What more do you need? He was from Wisconsin. That's all you need to know.
As a Wyoming fan, like, I hated playing those guys. Like, they were so tough, but like, everybody loved that fat guy. He was great.
So how are you doing, man?
I'm doing all right. Hey, you know, it's funny, you're talking about the changing landscape of college sports and college football and all this stuff, and it's I don't know, maybe it's because I'm from a small school or whatever. Maybe I'm getting too old. I don't know. I worry they're taking the fun out of the whole thing. And don't get me wrong, I don't begrudge these athletes, you know, getting a little bit of money. I mean, it's kind of interesting, but it's so curious. So I have two concerns, really. Is one is the fun is gone, but in reality, my school has been excluded from all the fun for a while, even though I've been hoping against that. So that's one thing, the fun is gone, and I'm worried that it will go further away. But the other thing is, you know, it's weird if you unwrap this whole, like, payment thing, which is kind of a merit-based system. Like, what the hell happens to, like, Title IX? Because, you know, suddenly nobody's watching women's basketball or whatever. You know, I don't mean to pick on women's basketball, but What happens to all this stuff? Does that all go by the wayside?
Well, Title IX is going to be absolutely a factor. Although I have to say, because I know people heard that, some people might like, women's basketball certainly this year was a different entity in and of itself. I mean, it's the first time the women's basketball final beat the men's basketball final. And whether
I am not a hater, by the way.
No, I know. But they literally, this was an unprecedented year where it's like, no, they actually had more viewers for the women, for a couple of those women's games with Iowa than they did for any college football game other than the national championship. That's how crazy it got towards the end. Like, the numbers that were coming out were wild. But that, setting that aside, that was a minor note. I think the Title IX factor in all of this is really fascinating because no one's sure how to weigh it, because that's why. The question is, would they come up with one of the more interesting arguments is, do they come up with an entirely new way to split off football? Because you've heard that, like, let's some proposals are, let's spin off football altogether and see if they could bypass some of the existing rules. The other reason they might want to split off football is, would that allow them, and maybe men's basketball and possibly at this point even women's basketball, if you split off those money-making sports, will that prevent the need to then offer everything to the non-revenue sports? Like, that's one theory. The problem is, all this stuff is totally untested and will almost certainly be litigated at some point or another, because there's a lot of money that could potentially be lost or left on the table. I mean, one argument that is plausible is that, would you force a lot of your athletic teams to be club sports suddenly, which sounds drastic. It is somewhat, but it isn't totally unheard of, because that's how a lot of international sports teams are handled. One of the weird things, and I don't want to, this is a huge conversation, because I remember we actually had it maybe a couple of months ago, but the United States is the only country that doesn't have a ministry of sport, or, you know, department of sport that truly sponsors usually it's for the Olympic sports, the non-revenue sports. So we're kind of left on our own in a lot of ways, and the colleges have sort of been the backbone. And part of it's just the history, I think, that colleges have sort of been that before the idea of organizing that sort of an entity on a national level was ever needed. But it'll be interesting to see, because Title IX is one of those big factors in all of it. And I don't think anyone's got a clear answer on where it's going to go, other than, yeah, we gotta keep an eye on it. Short of congressional action, which, again, on any sense isn't going to happen. You know, this is that it's got to be addressed, and it's unclear how it could be addressed.
You know, speaking of congressional action, I have wondered for years, how is it possible that all the little schools, and I'm worried about, I have my own gripes about my own congressional or representatives or whatever. How is it the little schools have not proposed legislation to stop this destruction of, you know, of their ability to even compete for a championship? I don't understand how this hasn't been political.
Well, if you think about it, it was at one point kind of, because if you remember the BCS era, Utah led the charge when they were in the Mountain West still, because their senators were 2-1. I believe they were able to just pull off we're going to call some congressional hearings and put the heat. And then the BCS did the plus one model. Because for those who are old, I know you're my age, so, or at least in my zone, you're actually, So, you know, you remember the original BCS, it was just the four bowls. It was just rotating between the so-called BCS bowls, you know, Orange, Sugar, Rose, Fiesta. The Fiesta was
be included. I'm old enough to remember the Bowl Alliance, which was before.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I mean, remember, it was originally those four. And then they added a fifth, so one of them got to double up each year as being the national championship game, so they could add that extra spot to add the plus one, which was the G5 inclusion. And then when we got the playoff, you know, the New Year's Six included a spot, and then Cincinnati had that really nice year where they made it into the obviously the college football final. But I think really, and this is where you get some interesting conversations, this is an awkward time for the G5 to try to do something, only because this is the best access they've ever had, a guaranteed spot, essentially, in probably the 12th seed, unless you have a really phenomenal, like a Cincinnati type of team. But the way it's set up now is there's always going to be a G5 team included. In fact, until they finally were able to settle with the Pac-2 to get them out, there was going to be a really awkward situation where they were going to still have the top five as they originally designed it. And with the Pac-12 where it was, they wouldn't have ever counted. So you would have ended up with the champions of the P4 and then two G5 conference champs, because that was the way they had written it. They said, like, the top five conference champs go in, top six, pardon me, conference champs go in. It was going to be the P5 plus one G5. And if they didn't change the language to being the top five conference finishers, you were going to essentially end up with two G5s in that conference, in the playoff this next year. But they've changed it. So now, of course, it's going to be presumably the P4 champs plus a G5 champ, with the theory that one could at large their way in. But that seems quite hopeful.
You know, the whole idea of this terminology, P5, G5, it is such nonsense. I mean, we're all Division I. You know, you go back to, I guess, BYU is probably the best example. Now, they won the national title in, what was it, 1984. That wouldn't be allowed today, just because of this stupid language. Like, the whole thing is silly. It's all made up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, and it's interesting too, because I think it comes from the way the NCAA actually defines autonomous conference. I think that's where it came from, because the Pac-12 got demoted, basically, because with the two members, actually last week, the NCAA officially demoted them out of the autonomous conference zone, because they're in a bind. They have 2 years, and it's actually set up interesting. They have 2 years to figure out what they're going to do. Those 2 years are going to be spent with Oregon State and Washington State trying to join the ACC or the Big 12. That's basically what we're going to be left with. And then after 2 years, the NCAA is going to give the grace period that they've been given to be a two-team conference will expire. And then most of the money that they've, you know, settled with, they've got a ton of money from the outgoing members, will have mostly run out. So at that point, they're going to have to figure out, okay, do we do a reverse merger with the Mountain West? Do we, what's the future for us? That's when we're going to get that kind of interesting window. You know, I want to also, and please stay up here, Mark, but I see one other person I've led up, and I see one other person waiting, and I want to get to everybody. Mage Ingrid, what's going on?
Oh, hey, sir. How are you doing?
Oh dear. My microphone is not listening. One second. Apologies. This has been a very annoying show for me because of the technical difficulties. I'll be right back.
Not again.
How you doing? How you doing, Mage?
Hey, how y'all doing?
Oh, no. Doing all right. You broke the system. What's up?
Yeah.
I did not.
We all broke it tonight.
My phone's fine. Nice to hear y'all talking about college football still, even though it's a long off season, too, I mean. I hate how long it is.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I'm back.
Sorry about that.
No. Apologies. So this has been once in a blue moon. We'd actually gone on a really great run without Twitter doing that to me. But this is like the third time where somebody is up, and it's a quirk where somebody waiting to talk, once they get let up, I can't hear them, and everyone else can, and it's really awkward. So I'll get like a message on like the Slack we use if one of the moderators is here or whatever, and they'll be like, hey, no, I can hear them. And I'll be like, oh, because it was so – anyway, apologize about that, Mage Ingrid. What's on your mind?
Okay, hang on a second. Hang on, quick question. Who was that talking to me? I didn't notice who that was. John was just talking to me right before you came back on.
That was Mark.
It was Mark. I'm sorry, what you were saying?
Sorry, I was responding, and you said something about you're happy to hear people talking college football in the off season, and I said, man, it's never a good season to not talk about college football. It's always on the table.
Oh, 100%.
I didn't hear how long the off season. I needed it. Honestly, like, why is it like half of the doggone year anyway, like. We only have this war for like 4 months, really, total.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
Clearly.
What else is on your mind?
Okay, well, the NFL draft, that was going to be fantastic. And I'm happy for Michigan and Texas, of course. So I'm like, oh, good. Papa got three of his boys coming with him to the Chargers. So that's fun.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been fun to see. I was also glad to see there was a guy from British Columbia, like the University of British Columbia, the Thunderbirds. Woo! Beautiful campus, by the way. Look up that campus. It is actually like on a peninsula surrounded by trees. you know, it almost makes you wish they cared about the sport more. But he's just a physical beast. So luckily they were able to sort that out. My other favorite was there's always good stories in the draft. So let's be clear about that. But there was that one guy where, like, even if you look at where he's from, they list him as England. Because again, he was one of the guys that came through that international kind of access program they have to encourage more players, you know, internationally to try out. And it's a cool idea, you know, to kind of encourage the, he was a rugby union player, Travis Clayton. He's on the Buffalo Bills, seventh rounder. But yeah, you know, guy who's got solid athletic skill, proved he could do it. And I love those stories. Nathan, I see. Oh, I thought you were putting your hand up. Sorry about that. That's the clap symbol. I got to remember that.
No, I was just clapping for a fellow rugger out there, you know. Love.
But anyway, yeah, so it's fun to see that. I'd love to see more internet. I mean, again, I'm going to just to kind of reiterate something that's kind of fun happening this weekend. I'm heading out to Oregon to see the college football national champion of Japan 6 times in a row. They've been playing football at the school since 1941. They're pretty good at what they do. Actually, I finally figured out why they're so good at it. When they introduced football, they had to take a break in the 40s. Something happened. I forgot. World War, something like that. But when they brought it back in the late 40s, they had a coach who was brilliant. Like, it was this private school. They had an associated junior high, an associated high school. And they said, you know, let's just introduce football in all the schools. So one school in Japan had like the ultimate pipeline, not because the guys were necessarily superstar football players, but because they were all playing football for 10 years. So by the time they'd get to be seniors, these guys had played football for 9 years before that. And it's really interesting because we once had an interview with a guy who actually, again, he was from Hawaii, played at Colorado, got an injury. So he didn't end up getting drafted, and he ended up playing pro ball in Japan and just stayed there. Now he lives in Japan. His wife is from Japan. And he was talking about, like, he just took a job coaching at a major university there, football. And he's like, my guys are athletic, but they've never played football before. So I'm trying to teach these guys to play defensive line, and I'm basically teaching them, like, from the get-go. So this other college, meanwhile, has been a farm for all of its time, and no wonder they – so that team has been successful. They're coming in to play Southern Oregon, an NAIA team out in Ashland, which is near Medford. The reason is – there was a coach there who originally was at Utah State who brought the very first team from the United States that did a tour, like a full-on college team, not like an all-star team. Like the University of Utah, pardon me, Utah State University went over to Japan in 1971, played a couple of, like, a series of exhibition games versus, like, all-star teams from the local universities. And they just, understandably, they kicked butt. But it wasn't just that they kicked butt. They also, like, were demonstrating technique and strategy that the Japanese had not seen yet. Like, there was another, like, one of the Japanese coaches was like, we were kind of embarrassed. They knew how to tape ankles. And we were like, man, we gotta figure out football a lot better. So that's why Chuck Mills, who was a coach at the time, he's nicknamed the father of modern football in Japan. Because at that point, they realized, all right, let's start. Then Mills was like a real, like, the more I read about Chuck Mills, and he passed away only a few years ago in 2021, and he was in his 90s at that point. But the way he was like, he originally visited Japan in 1970 to go to the World Expo, which was a really big popular event in 1970 in Osaka. And he was supposed to meet the coach, actually, of the same school that's coming to the United States. But they weren't able to meet up. And he remembered it. And he was really kind of like upset with himself that I really should, like, I owe it to football to be in contact with this other coach. So he sent that coach a letter. And the coach of Japan got the letter, was like, wow, this guy's like for real. So that set up the trip. And then afterwards, he said, like, I want as many of your players and coaches who want to come to the United States to come and just like be on my staff as, like, you know, I guess an offensive assistant, whatever you call him now, but just like observe. So a bunch of coaches did. And, you know, he went to Wake Forest for a few seasons. And then the bulk of the 80s, he was the head coach of this small NAIA school in Oregon called Southern Oregon. And that's why Southern Oregon has this tie to all of these Japanese universities, because that was the peak time for all of these coaches coming to train. So many of their best coaches in Japan have studied under him and been at Southern Oregon, as well as other universities. Like, Oklahoma has had a couple of successful coaches from Japan, like, study on the athletic department. I remember there was the first time I ever heard about this was this great profile of Pete Carroll during the glory years at USC. And they talked about, yeah, they've got this Japanese guy who's like not an intern, but he's from Japan and he's just watching. But Pete Carroll keeps asking him to come out and like in before every meeting and give like a motivational speech to give him practice. Except the guy does it in Japanese and the players just go along with it because he's so hype. So, you know, like this is a tradition that's been happening at many universities, kind of under the radar. So as kind of part of this, apparently in the 80s, they had three games that they called the Mills Bowl between this university, Kwansai Gakuin, and Southern Oregon. And so now they're bringing it back. And it's fascinating, too, because I've said it before. They've got college football all over the world. Canada's got it, unsurprisingly. Mexico has it, and it's increasing there as much as they love the NFL. And Finland's got it. There's a lot of other countries. But the countries that have always been the most passionate about it outside of the United States are Canada, but they've got their own version. Of course, Mexico, which has had it since the 20s, and Japan since the 1930s. So it's fun to see this. And there was even a game, and I tweeted about it earlier today because I was reminded. There's a very nice reporter in Oregon who asked me some questions about the team in Japan because I actually knew about it. And I kind of was going over a list of all the things that had happened. And in 2016, because in 2015, this same Japanese school hosted Princeton. And that was a bit of an outmatched situation because Japan has big guys. They certainly have big guys. The problem is, if you're a big guy in Japan, you're told as a kid you should be probably a sumo wrestler. So they're really big athletic guys end up going into a different sport. They have linemen, but they're not quite as big as our linemen. So when Princeton, you know, they're non-scholarship, but the Ivy League ain't no joke. They get in the top 25 of the FCS football rankings. They just don't participate in the tournament. They went over there and absolutely, you know, the skilled players in Japan were good, but the line just, they were running for their lives because the Princeton linemen were running right through them. We'll see, you know, the next year they went to Mexico City and played the oldest Mexican team, which is UNAM, National Autonomous University in Mexico City. Beautiful campus. They have a stadium they built in 1952 for football. It was soccer and football, but it was purposely built for both. It's probably the only American football stadium in the world that has a Diego Rivera mural on the outside of it. But they played in that stadium in 2016, Kwansai Gakuin against the Pumas CU, which is the name of their team. And it was a close match. It was 17-13. The Japanese team won. So now we're going to finally, the pandemic obviously disrupted a lot of travel, but now they're coming back, coming to the United States. It's going to be there Saturday. It's going to be a rainy game. They don't have a press box, so I'm going to be on the sideline. It'll be a heck of a game. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be raining too, so I'm going to buy some rain gear. I have snow gear, but that's going to be way too hot for what's going over there. But they have an REI in Medford, so I'm going to go probably buy myself a rain jacket, some rain pants. I've got the right shoes. I'm not worried about the shoes, but it'll be something else. Can't wait. That's going to be exciting. That's going to be college football. They should do more of this. And I just want to go back. So that Utah State trip in 1971, the NCAA wouldn't allow it. The Nixon administration stepped in because they were like, no, we gotta, let's do this. You know, this is the same era of Nixon going to China, you know, and opening up we gotta strengthen our ties. When the president says, like, can you like look past this rule for this one trip? They were like, all right. So that loosened up. Now the official, by the way, the official rule for international exhibition trips, if you're in football, it's specifically only in football. If you're a non-scholarship school, you can go on a foreign tour is how they classify it. Once every, I think, like 3 years. And then, so D3 teams will sometimes take those international trips. And Princeton was able to also do it because they're a non-scholarship football team. So the Pioneer League of Football and the Ivy League are the D1 conferences that technically qualify for that. So there you go. More than you all ever thought you'd hear about the realm of international college football, because I love the sport. I want to see it grow around the world. And you know what? As John mentioned on the outset of the show, he watched that game because in Japan, they play a spring season. It's totally like for fun, not for funds, but it's like an exhibition season where it's like they use a lot of the underclassmen in game settings. And they had like 6,000 people show up to this game between two rival universities. Oh, and I got to add, because I always like to mention this, they have promotion and relegation in Japan. So it was a big deal because this rivalry game was being played for the first time in like 5 years because one of the two teams had gotten relegated and then the pandemic screwed up everything for them. So these two, you know, private universities in Tokyo were having a game and 6,000 people showed up And they got cheers, man. They like to cheer there. It's a, their cheerleading is like a whole different ball game. If you've ever seen Japanese baseball, you'll know what I'm talking about. They, it's very percussive based. Like people chant, like do like hand gestures. Actually, it's kind of like Texas A&M now that I'm saying it, now that I'm kind of thinking about it. But yeah, anywho, I've been kind of going all over the place here. You know, Dr. Pepper Bucko, you've been super patient here. What's on your mind?
First off, one, that's impressive. And two, I learned that Japan has football. And yes, Japan, yeah, they have crazy crowds.
Yeah, they do. Absolutely. Oh, my goodness. So what are you thinking as a Pitt fan heading into the end of spring games are all done? What's the vibe for you as a Pitt fan right now?
Win 9 games, please. Quarterback play, that it's going to be good. I believe in Nate Narnow. Hayes, I don't know, from saying hail to Pitt to going to Colorado and saying that we just ain't good.
Yeah, that was hilarious, wasn't it? Like he goes on a big speech when he leaves to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, the arguably one of the best, if not the best players on the team. Goes out there and then makes this big scene about like, I want to go on a team that can win now, and then joins Colorado, where you're kind of like, okay.
what are they? Wide receivers are leaving, right? Am I correct?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, so I mean, it is something else. Yeah, it absolutely is. So we'll see where that goes. But again, Pitt's going to be interesting to see this season. I know we've talked about this before, but that West Virginia game, for a lot of reasons in week 3, that's going to be the one where I'm going to be very curious. That is going to be fun to see that rivalry game and two teams that are going to be looking really kind of to make their statement against each other. That's what we love in college football. Let's see here. I got a couple of hands up here. Mage Ingrid, what's on your mind?
Okay, two things. So, if anybody watched Jeopardy, I saw that the Rose Bowl this year was on flew on Jeopardy. I'm like, oh, that's sweet. I kind of think it was gonna happen that quick. I'm like, dang, already. Was it April the 5th? I think it was a clue. I'm like, oh wow, that's nice. And second, one second thing. Now, what about flag football? Because I think it's an Olympic sport now. I think.
Yeah, I think are they trialing it, or is it going to be a medal sport? Because I don't remember.
I don't know, but I heard it's supposed to be an Olympic sport. If it ain't is already, just not going to be at this year's Olympics, I think.
I think it's going to be
at the LA, I think.
Yeah,
the 2028.
Yeah, Major, I can answer that. Yeah, it is approved as a sport for 2028. Not this year, but it will be a medal sport in 2028 in LA.
Oh, that's great. That's wonderful. You know, because folks may not realize the IOC, which is, you know, International Olympic Committee, there's actually an interesting hierarchy when you look at Olympic sports, because they recognize certain federations and they're somewhat independent of each other, but any sports federation wants to essentially become IOC recognized. And so there is one for American football that does oversee flag and touch, and it's the International Federation of American Football, the IFAF, and it's out there. It's not a particularly strong entity, but they would be the ones that kind of, so the reason there's a hierarchy there. So IOC will recognize the IFAF, and then the IFAF will have its regional organizations kind of structure. They're not big. We're not talking like huge offices here. And then like kind of like how soccer works, where there's like the different geographic separations of the soccer leagues. And then from there, they have the relationships with the national governing bodies. So USA Football, again, we're unique in that USA Football is not a governmental or related to the government in some way, like most ministries of sports that other countries have. But USA Football is the governing body for international football competition in the United States. So if there is a flag football team in the United States in the Olympics, which there obviously will be, that will then therefore be part of the IFAF Americas, because they always like to pool both North and South America into one. And then the IFAF Americas is part of the IFAF, which is recognized by the IOC. So that's what most people don't know this. It's so funny. The reason I know this so fresh off my mind is I'm working with the this is a side project with the College Football Hall of Fame, and I'm putting together a global football kind of like collection of stuff that I've gathered. And one of the random things I have is a helmet from one of the tournaments. It's actually a Japan helmet, as it turns out. But I had to like, I didn't want to just give him a random helmet and not explain what it's about. So I wrote out all of this. I'm like, here's what you need to know. Here's the context. If you're going to put it out on display, you know, you don't have to write all of this, but here's kind of like how to put it in the context so that you know and you can actually explain the dang thing. But yeah, so that's international football. It is. I love the sport so much. What can I say? What can I say? John, your hands up.
Yeah, I did have something very important to discuss, and everyone else can jump in because I think this is something everyone needs to hear. As you guys might have saw on Twitter today, that's not football really, so apologies in advance. But Dave and Buster's announced that they're going to allow gambling
yes.
at facilities. Not talking like betting on football games and stuff like that. I'm talking betting on arcade games. I'm talking betting on skee ball.
Wait a minute, hang on. What?
Yes, what? Betting on skee yes. ball. Betting on yeah. like Papa Shot. Like you can bet on anything they have there. And the amount of chaos that's going to bring on college football Saturdays for anyone going to a Dave and Buster's is going to be incredible. There's going to be you're going to see a grown man lose money on the USC game and then lose the rest of his money on Papa Shot within a 10-minute span. I hope you guys are ready for the chaos and greatness that's going to be at a Dave and Buster's this fall.
All I gotta say is like for the chaos that sometimes erupts at Chuck E. Cheese, because you know, and people have written about it, it's like the tension, you got your kids near you, so people are more likely to be defensive and angry. Like throw money into it. Like Chuck E. Cheese has got to get in on this. Now what am I saying? Chuck E. Cheese. You should like talk to Chuck and bet some money on skee ball as your kids compete and birthday parties get you know, like, because that's the thing. People are like, are people gonna get like? Does Dave and Buster's know the idea of putting money in some of? But my favorite was somebody was like on Twitter. You know, will it analyze your kids' shooting ability at these games so they can then put up like handicap odds on you know the spread or you know the you know that could be like
yeah, it's. Oh,
it's been funny.
I'm fully prepared to watch a guy lose his car because he bet on 2 9-year-olds motorcycle racing at the arcade. I'm fully ready to see it.
And what do they do if somebody just goes and pulls the car of the game in the back? You know, like, oh, there's so much chaos there. My goodness.
Do you think
come up about my car? I'll be my dad again and again. That's going to be funny.
Do you think they've amped up their security or done anything to, like, prepare themselves?
Go ahead, Nathan. I know you were starting to speak.
Or I was saying, do you think Dave and Buster's has like drastically increased their security, or are they ready for their stores to become like a gambling hall?
How will this affect the sports players' gambling addiction?
Yeah, they don't think about the players in this situation. I'm really curious to see what happens. Like for the situation where like someone pays a kid of like to personally lose a Dance Dance Revolution, so the under hits. Like there's a lot of potential scenarios here that people are not thinking about for the integrity of sports gambling, of course.
Oh my goodness. Well, I think this is a good spot to sort of wrap this up. We've got a little far afield, and I love it because this is the off season, and we got more of it coming up. So I'm gonna just say,
Hey, can I ask one question?
Sure.
Just before you, I'm really sorry if
no, not at all, not at all, man.
Anything here, but you were talking about international stuff, and it reminded me of when there was like an NFL Europe, I think it was called.
Yeah.
And you were talking about Japan and the popularity of football over in Japan, but as I recall, back in those days, and my beloved Wyoming Cowboys actually were the recipient of one of this. As I recall, the Germans were huge football fans, actually, as far as NFL Europe. Like I say, Wyoming actually got a German player. I was curious, you didn't mention Germany in the group of countries that love football.
Well, oh, no, and I was talking college football specifically. So you're gotcha, absolutely okay. Right. Germany, Denmark, and Austria. But especially Germany and Austria are big, big places for football. And NFL Europe kind of had a successor that still exists. It's the European League of Football. Yeah, it's ELF. But it is they do have tournaments, and occasionally you'll see it on – they'll broadcast it online. So, I mean, they had 17 teams last season. So they're for real, and they still exist. And most of the teams are German and Austrian. There's a couple of Swiss teams. There's a couple of – there are actually some decent French players out there, and some of them have even made it to the U.S. in some way. Like, there was a really interesting French player about, gosh, before the pandemic, where he went to a junior college in California so he could get tape. So he'd already played for years in France. But there was no tape there. So he went, and then he was on Purdue's squad for a while. I don't think he went to the NFL, but I was like, wow, that's a dude who really wants to be a player, you know? And there've been guys from Denmark and a couple of other places that have made it onto college teams as well as recruits. But absolutely. There's a handful of college teams in that area. One of my favorites, I forgot what the name of the Austrian university is, but they're called the Robots. And they had a hilarious hype video that I shared on our Twitter account actually a couple of months ago. And it was just like they put all this money, like not too much money, but it was filmed so kind of sleekly. But yeah, they are 100% into football, but there it's more like it's almost like a club sport that's grown into like a pro league that is not like a super duper pro league. But they got passion there. So absolutely, Mark, you're 100% right.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm glad to hear it. I'm also glad to hear some rugby talk here just briefly. And there is that Wales player, I think he's a winger, who joined – oh, shoot, it's not college. I'm sure he joined the NFL, actually.
Yeah, Travis Clayton. Yeah, he's with the international program there. Yeah, so he's going to be a lineman. And, yeah, he was picked in the seventh round by the Bills. So that's great. I mean, they've had a couple of guys do that. There was a really funky kind of situation where technically he was an Ohio State guy, but he didn't play for the team. The football team. He was a track guy from Nigeria through Scotland, I believe. And so he also went through this NFL access program. I'm sure he's a undrafted free agent somewhere. But it was funny because his last year at Ohio State, he played for Ohio State's club football team, which is a tackle team. And I thought it was kind of funny because like he ended up being really good. And then, yeah, he's technically the first kid who's ever been on a club team to get an NFL tryout. But he didn't make the draft. I'm curious to see where he lands. His name has slipped my mind. But, yeah, but Travis Clayton, though, it was really funny because, again, as I mentioned a little while back, where they were kind of the random schools you see appearing on the list, and he was listed as England rather than a school. And then, of course, Quantes Stiggers, I should mention him only because he had a really kind of an interesting career. He originally was going to be he was going to play college football, and then he had at Lane College. And then as a freshman, though, he had to leave his school almost immediately because his father, unfortunately, was killed in a car accident. So he ended up dropping out of college because of depression he was having. And then he ended up like, well, he wanted to get back into football. So he joined I did not know this league existed. It was called it's still, I think, out there. It's on hiatus, called a fan controlled football league, which was an indoor American football league. And it is basically doing this is a joke that people have had, where basically you're playing a mob controlled football, like online controlled, like they're the ones that send the plays in. So he played a year of this, but he was good enough to then get into the CFL. So he was on the Argonauts. So he played Canadian football, but the thing was, he still was young enough that I don't know how this works, but he qualified for the NFL draft. And then the guy ends up being drafted in the fifth round. So he's really unique. He doesn't have a college, because he was only at Lane College for like a hot second. But he's technically a draftee off of the Toronto Argonauts. But the guy's American. He's from, you know, he's from Georgia, for the record. But man, those were some of the more interesting stories that we got out of this draft. And of course, the guy from British Columbia who I mentioned.
That's awesome. The guy I was talking about, I think, is actually Rhys Zammit. He's a Welsh guy, and he was at South Florida, I believe, is where he did his pro day.
Oh, anyway. Interesting. I wonder. I wouldn't be surprised if he's an undrafted free agent, because again. Lots of guys, some guys, you know, again, for people who don't, I mean, there's only a handful of, I mean, there's, okay, 257 draft spots, but that's still not that many spots. it always points out exactly how hard it is to get on an NFL team. Because, I mean, there's college football players. I've said it before. At any given year, there's roughly 40,000 college football players out there. When you add all of these divisions together. So vying for a league that's got 1,600 and change spots, it's tough. So one of the reasons I do appreciate NIL is a lot of guys who are getting money who had no chance of getting a real payday. But I'm going to go ahead and slowly, though, start wrapping this up, only because it's been going on now for about an hour and 15 minutes. And my technical difficulties have been kind of a headache this particular show. Not any of your fault. Probably not my fault. We'll just blame the internet tubes. But on behalf of all of us here at RCFB, my name is Bob Ekaieri. We do these every Tuesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern. It's an opportunity just to talk about college football with you, listen to you, hear your thoughts. I always enjoy it. Lots of fun topics to bring up. If you're into podcasts, I do a podcast for the Advanced Media Group. They hired me to do it. I do it with CBS Sports' Hanjay Araja. It's called the College Football Survivor Show. In the season, we talk about the race for the CFP playoff. But in the offseason, we've been doing a lot of kind of like, well, what's the topic of the day? So it's something else you can listen out for if you're into your podcast. But I will, once this is done, this will turn into a recording. And then we'll go ahead and put this as well on RCFB Talk, wherever you get your podcasts and recording as well. So, want to thank all of you for listening. I'm going to hang up and listen.